Penguin Random House Audio presents Good Morning, Destroyer of Men's Souls, a memoir of women, addiction, and love. This is the author, Nina Renata Aaron. Dedication for my mother and father. Part 1. Chapter 1. On a hunter's moon, I burned his name. The drummer in my band told me to do it. We were sitting at the bar drinking well whiskeys and cans of beer. A hunter's moon is powerful for intention setting, she said, winding her long, chemically straightened hair into an apple fritter-sized bun atop her head. She secured it not with an elastic, but with a wrist flick and a twist of another piece of her hair, some sleight of hand I'd always envied in the girls who could do it. It stayed in place perfectly. She pulled a few baby hairs out to fall in front of her ears, and they made small, wispy parentheses around her face. Fleetwood Mac was playing. "Write down what you want and burn it," she said, knocking back the last of her drink. Women suggest these types of things to one another. A hunter's moon is powerful for intention setting. This was the kind of oblique advice I was getting a lot. I didn't know where to hook into it, how to listen better to make it feel real, like something I could act on. Still, I let it wash over me, this language I was trying to learn. My earnest, beautiful California girlfriends, knowing I needed them, were doing their very best, circling with candles and crystals. I welcomed their warmth the way I imagined I was supposed to, with an open, wistful gaze and slow, new-age nodding. Just that week, one had shown up with a bottle of rosé and made the measured, straight-faced suggestion that I sage him from the premises. "This will cleanse your space of him," she said, proffering a bound, faded bundle of expired flora and a lighter. I was constantly cleansing him from my space. Every few days, for example, I'd clean our bathroom, wiping with Lysol-drenched paper towels the delicate spray of dried blood that lay over most surfaces and reminded me of the splatter of colored dye on the outside of a jawbreaker, the first layer that makes a white paste in your mouth as you suck it away. Living with a junkie involves a lot of effluvia. Everywhere there are oozes that must be wiped away. It seems there's simply more of it all. The sweat that goes immediately cold on the dysregulated slab of his body. Piss that didn't make it into the toilet bowl. There's blood and vomit every day, and the rotten, volcanic secretions of abscesses. And when I come home from work and he lunges for me, kisses me, all baby and half on the nod, and we fuck dreamily, devotedly, on the couch. There's spit and there's cum. Sometimes in the trash can, I find wadded-up paper towels or bits of toilet paper he's used to wipe the blood away himself. And sometimes blood-stained T-shirts or socks or floral dish towels, which stiffen as they dry as though rigor mortis has set in. I didn't know how to tell my friends, those well-meaning rays of blonde hope, that intention setting was already my life. Intention setting was the blistering fever that came over me when I couldn't reach him, and I had to type fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you over 4 inches of an email box, my version of a breathing exercise, until I could calm down and go back to my work. My drafts folder was full of these 10-point fuck you blocks, and hundreds of other half-written love letters and hate letters I'd nearly lobbed his way, all intentions to reform or renounce him. Intention setting was what I was doing all those mornings I pulled the car over to cry with my head on the steering wheel. It was the cement resolve I felt harden in my gut when I saw how much money was missing from my bank account. It was the ominous thump of my own helplessness, the rhythm of my days and nights. What I needed was something for intention keeping. "Do they make a tincture for that?" I wanted to ask. "Some rose petal elixir to heal me?" Later that night, I did as my drummer friend said. I stood above my kitchen sink, swaying slightly, rocking the bourbon baby of my body, and burned a small strip of printer paper on which I'd written, "KMS, I am letting go of you," in junk drawer ballpoint pen. I'd considered, "I want to let go of you." "Write down what you want," she'd said. But that seemed too aspirational, not present tense enough. "No, I don't want to. I am." The paper curled hot orange, and tears welled in my eyes as the flame climbed slowly closer to my hand. I wanted it to be satanic, the dark, measured wildness of casting a spell, untying and setting loose some force in the universe. It felt more like something out of a Taylor Swift video, a pathetic, over-earnest micro-victory against obsessive love while my eyeliner ran. The tiny blaze appeared perfectly controlled. I let the ashes fall into the dirty cereal bowls, narrowing my eyes to summon the sense that this time would be consequential. I really mean it this time, the refrain of sick people the world over. The thing is, you do mean it each time. That night I certainly did. I swallowed the lump in my throat and thought, I am letting go, motherfucker, starting right now. The disease he has is addiction. It's in the headlines every day, killing more people than ever before, taking over the country. I look at graphs in the newspapers showing steep, almost vertical upticks in overdoses and deaths. I read all the stories about the cheap, pure Mexican heroin flooding the market, about school-age kids left to fend for themselves as their parents descend, then disappear, about small-town librarians carrying Narcan to reverse the overdoses happening in their bathrooms, about the cops in a futile, all-out war to stem the tides of supply and skyrocketing demand. At work, I surreptitiously watch Vice videos about Canadian teenagers panhandling so they can snort crushed-up Smurf Blue fentanyl, chasing ever-shorter highs. They amble around hot parking lots, sending text messages in search of 10 more minutes of oblivion, more pills they can crush into the powder they snort off the backs of public toilets. You can see any prospect of future joy receding as their faces slacken and their lids grow heavy. But even the constant reporting on the recent surge in drug horrors, seen as more horrifying now that the people affected are increasingly whiter and younger, cannot adequately document its monstrousness. Each time I read one of these stories, watch a film, or look at a graph, I think about all that lies outside the frame, the heartaches those headlines don't show, the creeping messes they won't account for and couldn't possibly contain. They say addiction is a family disease, and I ponder this a lot, the astonishing rippling outward of bad decisions and risky behaviors, the impound lots, eviction notices, and pawned heirlooms, lives caught up just as mine is in managing everyday grief, accommodating each day a little bit more than you ever thought you could handle. A cool morning in early autumn, Oakland, California. Kay, as I'll call him, is poised to get out of the car and onto the BART train to head to a job I'm not certain he actually has anymore. He presses play on the music on his phone and pulls the hood of his black sweatshirt, the addict's veil, gruffly up over his headphones. In the way a different person, me, might straighten her skirt or reach for her purse, Kay readies himself for public view with a series of small, personal movements. They are designed to hide as much of himself as possible. In more desperate times, he has ridden the train looking for people to rob, seizing upon couples he could intimidate by threatening to hit the woman. He wouldn't hit a woman, he said when he first revealed this to me, but the tactic always worked. And the guy gets a moment to shine, he added. All he has to do is fork over the cash and he looks like a hero. But Kay's habit is not that out of control at the moment, and besides, he has me. His waking hours are a careful calculus. To get from sunrise to sundown, he needs $40, 30 for heroin and 10 for crack. Maybe a couple bucks more from the change jar for one of those plastic containers of lemon or lime juice that junkies use to break down crack. Bodegas in bad neighborhoods sell them on the counter. I used to wonder what they were for. He doesn't actually shoot drugs in front of me. The actual moments when he's getting high are more like an open secret between us. He usually goes to the bathroom to do it, and I can often hear him humming innocuously from behind the door, sometimes whistling, sounding carefree and maybe a little excited, like he's Mr. Rogers buttoning his cardigan and donning his loafers, readying himself for a wholesome adventure. He'll do the first shot, a combination of the two, to get the first high of the day, the only true high. After so many years of shooting dope, speedballs are the quickest way to feel something. He'll do a second shot of the heroin he saved later to come down a bit from that bell-ringing height. And he'll need another one at night, but will rarely have enough left. His evening shot will just be a rinse, the weak residue of heroin left over in the cotton. It would be best if he could save himself a wake-up shot for the following morning, but he never finds a way to. Does anyone? The wake-up shot might be a junkie myth. At night he might have a drink or take some pills or smoke some weed, but none will quell the mushrooming dope sickness, or the fear of dope sickness, which he tells me is just as strong as the sickness itself, that will peel him out of sleep around 4 a.m. I linger, a light panic, throughout the morning.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?